The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Sunday, February 1st Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. A couple of quick announcements for you. For those of you who would like to call and talk to our guest today, who I'll introduce in a minute, Dr. Doug Plata, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let the phone ring. We'll answer it and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. If you do send in emails, please do your best to keep them short and to the point. As I keep saying, it's very hard to read long emails on air and have them make sense and not bore everybody to death. So short, to the point, and sweet. Email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember we're copyrighted and trademarked, but you do have permission to download our shows and share them and pass them around. Very few restrictions. Don't do anything commercial with the shows. No edits, please. And then, in addition, no written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. If you have any questions about any of this, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We podcast through gigadial.net. You can find our RSS URL on our website, both our short-form email newsletter and the newsletter that is on the website. And hopefully you won't have any podcasting questions, but if you do, shoot me an email and be glad to do my best to answer. We're in iTunes and a host of other places on the net. If you'd like to see us appear podcasting in another location as well, send me your suggestion. And again, any questions or issues or challenges with your podcast, even if it's with a smartphone, go ahead and email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, which is our website, by the way. So on our website, there's a very detailed newsletter that will be uploaded after today's show. And that website newsletter has all the information about the guest bios, full information about the show. And also, it's the only place we have a future events section. And then if we change our schedule during the week, and that does happen from time to time, we always do it first, and maybe the only place we do it, depending on timing, is the website newsletter. So do check it to see that the show you expect to hear is what you're going to hear. If for some reason you don't do that and you tune in and what you thought you were going to hear isn't there, go look at the website newsletter, because if we've had to change the schedule, you're going to find it there. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website and our blog, thespaceshow.wordpress.com, and you can also download the programs. And on the blog, don't forget, you can exchange notes with other listeners, and many of the guests will participate in a dialogue with the listeners. There's a Space Show store on our site, upper left-hand corner, says Space Show Gear. Check it out. The big important button, support the Space Show. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3. With onegiantleapfoundation.org. And we exist because many of you do support us and make contributions to us. Remember, you get a tax deduction on the federal side as well as the California side if you pay California taxes. If you have any questions, visit us at onegiantleapfoundation.org or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then finally, I'm happy to say that we are going to be sponsored again, or at least partially sponsored, by Secure World Foundation for 2015. Secure World promotes cooperative solutions for space security. And for more information, visit them at their own website and look through their material. They do a lot of really cool things. www.swfound.org. And they also sponsor our webinar series. So again, 2015 will be working with Secure World, and we certainly look forward to that. And that brings me to our show today. So Dr. Doug Plata is back with us, this time as a guest rather than as a space show caller or emailer. He is a physician from Southern California, and he's going to be discussing some of his concepts regarding the initial lunar base. He takes a solutions-based approach while addressing the challenges inherent in a project like a lunar base. He is a doctor, as I said, and a public health specialist in Loma Linda, California. His undergraduate degree was in biophysics, and he went on to complete his MD and MPH with specialty training in family and preventative medicine. His involvement in space has emerged only in the last couple of years. His primary interest in space is the development of assist lunar transportation infrastructure based upon lunar polar ice for propellant. A description of his concept can be found at cislunar1.com. He established the online Lunar COTS petition, which has attracted signatures of individuals from NASA, industry, academia, advocacy organizations, and space journalists. Doug, welcome back. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Excuse me, where do you want to start? Take us in an orderly fashion through initial lunar base structures and setup.
Okay, first of all, I'd probably like to refer the listeners to materials that they can look at while they're listening, if that's convenient for them. But recognizing that not everybody listening to the show is going to be able to look at them, I'll go ahead and describe.
Well, they should. They only can listen to the show if they're on the Internet.
Yeah, but I listen to it, like, on my iPhone.
Okay.
Like, if I'm driving, so. So I'll be descriptive for people who cannot look at it. But if the listeners would go to cislunar1.com/base, B-A-S-E, there are a couple of documents there that you can look at while I'm presenting. And cislunar1 is C-I-S-L-U-N-A-R-O-N-E, so you spell out the word one.com. And everything's lowercase, no underscores or spaces, of course. So if people would go there. David, do you have those things pulled up yourself?
I'm pulling it up now.
Okay. So there's two materials. If you just go to cislunar1.com/base, it's a little web page that has pictures of that, you know, sort of describe the concept, very concise. And then there's also a hyperlink to Lunar Base 1 reference materials, and this is sort of more extensive materials that show technology at different TRL levels related to what we're talking about here.
Okay, I have it pulled up, so.
Okay. So let me just maybe give an overview of the concept, and I think this presentation is sort of a follow-up to an earlier show, maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, in which a lot of the challenges for establishing an initial base were described. And in my conversation with you, David, you said, hey, the solutions that you're suggesting, why don't you come on the show and sort of describe the solution to those challenges. Looking at this cislunar1.com/base, there is a picture of, an example, nothing real serious, but just sort of what a lunar base could look like with sort of an emphasis on the aesthetics of it. But then going to the second panel, in the upper left-hand corner is a picture from Hawaii. This is the Pisces project, but it's maybe not Pisces, but it's Resolve is the rover that NASA plans on sending to the South Pole in 2019, and it is part of the lunar prospecting mission in which they're actually trying to characterize within Sabeas Crater. This is the very crater that was struck by an upper stage and kicked up the icy dirt, the regolith, into the sunlight in the image, and that was the study. I think it was back in 2009 when they conducted this mission that demonstrated that 5.6% or one part out of 18 of the regolith there is ice, with the bulk of that being water. Actually, it's 5.6% water by weight. And so this Resolve rover is going to sort of be on the edge, and will sort of quick run into the shadows and sample and be able to try to characterize it. And this is absolutely critical. We need to understand the physical nature of the ice, the distribution of it both vertically and horizontally. And the result of that is going to inform the construction of ice harvesting equipment. So that's the Resolve mission. And then in the top center is a picture of what the Falcon Heavy will look like. Basically, I'm saying that Falcon Heavy is high enough probability based on the fact that Falcon 9s form the basis for it. And we've had, I think it's now 12 flights of the Falcon 9, which is the equivalent of, four Falcon Heavies. And there's already a flight that's intended to be launched third quarter of this year. If they have a bit of delay and goes into 2016, no problem from this perspective, because the Falcon Heavy should be flying, I think, well before we would have any sort of lunar COTS program running. Actually, at this point, David, maybe we could describe for the listeners what lunar COTS is?
Yeah, that would probably be a good starting point.
Okay, lunar COTS is a concept that I sort of am the lead proposer. And if the listeners wanted to go to lunarcots.com, there's an online petition. If you'd like to look over and see who all else is signing it and look at the wording on the petition, if you'd like to join the others in signing it, I'd like to invite you to do that. Lunar COTS, the concept is to basically simply follow on with the current public-private programs. That's the COTS program, which is now completed, the commercial resupply service, which is ongoing, and then the commercial crew programs, which is in development and will get started in about 2017 with the first commercial delivery or private delivery of NASA astronauts to the International Space Station. These public-private programs are, I think, it's fair to say, recognized as some of the most successful and cost-effective programs that NASA is doing. Studies show that it was between one-third and one-eighth the cost of doing it, of developing the Falcon 9, than if it had been developed using a FAR or federal acquisition regulations approach. And so the lunar COTS says, hey, that's great for low Earth orbit, but why don't we extend America's commercial space throughout cislunar space to develop a cislunar transportation infrastructure to be able to access the resources of the moon, especially the ice at the poles of the moon for propellant, to be able to have a fairly low-cost, robust, reusable cislunar transportation infrastructure. And it would continue at the current public-private program portion of the budget of NASA, which is, I think it's now about 4%, heading towards 5%. And so that's what my recommendation would be as a follow-on to the current programs. So we need to prospect to characterize the ice launching on something as, I mean, it could be on two Delta IVs or one Falcon Heavy or certainly one SLS, even Block 1. So there's options in terms of launchers. But even a Falcon Heavy would be sufficient for a one-way mission for a teleoperated equipment, not for people, but for teleoperated. And in the upper right-hand corner, and if anybody's joining us late, we're at cislunar1.com/base, and the word one is spelled out. There is a depiction of the Mast and Zeus lander. This is a modification of ULA's Centaur upper stage, which has an extremely high and very good flight history. And what Maston would do is to modify that stage so that it can go ahead and land on the surface of the moon using propulsion modules that are placed on it. And so I would say that the Zeus lander is, you could say it's maybe 75% developed already, simply because most of the development would be that cryogenic stage, which ULA has already developed. I had the privilege about 6 weeks ago of visiting Maston Space Systems up in up in Mojave and got to see the two Centaur stages that ULA has on loan to Maston Space Systems, and they're neat. They're really impressive. Then on the right-hand side, there's a dark black picture with bright colors, and what this shows is the illumination percentage at certain points on the moon, at the poles of the moon. And there are places called peaks, so-called peaks of eternal light, in which it has greater than 90 or close to 100% sunlight throughout the lunar day. And so these would be great places to go ahead and set up solar panels and a lunar base because you have nearly continuous power. And my proposal, and I'm certainly not the only one proposing this, is that we land the lander at that location and set up solar panels and then connect power from there down into where the volatiles are probably the highest concentration, which is at the base of the craters, where it's in permanent shadow. And so there's a left-hand picture showing just a simple drawing of how a lander could be hopping from the rim down into the bottom and could either be draping a wire, or a wire could have been shot down. And then the lander lands at the end of the wire, connects, and now you have nearly permanent sunlight powering the operations at the base of the crater.
Now, which picture is this? I'm getting lost. Is this the one with the red line on it?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Next to the bottom of the Falcon Heavy.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I don't have the pictures numbered, but I'll just try to describe.
Okay, well, I'm caught up with you, so I know where you are.
Okay. And then there's, to do this operation, you actually need relatively few pieces of hardware to make this happen. This is, I want to banish the thought that this is mining. I don't like to use the word mining because it implies, you know, jackhammers and rocks and crushing stuff, et cetera. And that's not what we're talking about at all. Dr. Spoutis cites some of the L-Cross people, researchers, who say that it seems when the regolith was kicked up that the ice was within the fluffy material, which is, if that's true, and if Resolve proves that out, that's going to be awfully handy because it means we can simply easily scoop it up and steam out the ice from the regolith. I think we do need a dexterous telerobot to be able to help doing fine things such as connecting wires and possibly, you know, popping off using quick-release mechanisms, parts, and putting on spare parts in order to keep the operations running as long as possible. The nice thing is NASA really, this is very highly developed technology. NASA, working with GM, has the Robonaut and Robonaut 2, and I think that would be a really excellent piece of equipment to have on the moon. Not too massive, so it could fit within the mass budget. And then the bottom center of that first panel, I think that's a picture of Mike Duke, this is a sort of smaller scale than what I would like to see, but this is a laboratory model of a ice harvester, or I should say it probably wasn't designed for ice harvesting, but it scoops up regolith and brings it into its body. And what I would imagine is that instead of having to have a separate transporter to transport icy regolith to an oven, instead I would just use the body of the ice harvester to be able to enclose the icy regolith and simply heat up the inside and be able to steam out the volatiles fairly easily onto containers like on the back of the ice harvester. And then it simply poops out the dry regolith and moves forward a few more feet and excavates more of the icy regolith. Again, we don't know the nature, the physical nature of the water, and so there are alternate proposals such as drilling down, if there's a sort of a solid layer of ice, drilling down and microwaving it out and steaming it out in situ. Both approaches would need to make sure that there's as little amount of dust being kicked up because of the dangers of the abrasive regolith in the parts of the ice harvester. But Greg Baden, when he was on the show, the space show in 2011, he says, that doesn't concern him because in mining operations, they deal with dust all the time, so he thinks that that's a something that they're really quite competent to be able to address. The bottom right-hand picture is a picture of a terrestrial. This is a real picture of somebody who is running teleoperations in the mining industry, and this is the direction that the mining industry is going to try to get people out of the mine and have them in a safe environment where they're doing the teleoperations. Now, in panel two, it has to deal more with the base itself and some of the sort of the human factors. In the upper left-hand picture is from the University of Maine. I got to speak with Dr. Ali Abadi about this inflatable, the circular inflatable structure that was donated to them by NASA. And this is, I think it's about 42 feet in diameter, and it's sort of a donut-shaped structure. And my proposal, in which I think addresses a lot of the challenges in setting up a base, is completely get away with construction early on and simply construct the inflatable on Earth and then land it on the moon in a folded-up manner, and then simply by opening a pressure valve on compressed air tank, let it unfold and inflate itself. My specific approach, and I'm not the only one who suggests this, is to actually find a crater of approximately the correct size and actually put the inflatable down in the crater and then inflate it and then simply have your telerobots push the dirt from the rim of the crater down on top of the inflatable habitat. And this is probably, you know, about the easiest and lowest risk approach to cover the habitat with regolith for protection from radiation, thermal protection, and micrometeorites. And then in the second panel, the top center picture is interesting. I have, in researching for this show, I've come to find out that I think it's possible from the very get-go to be able to get a full artificial gravity within a shielded environment. In other words, the size of the habitat that a centrifuge would be in and the radius of the centrifuge could actually work from the very beginning. It wouldn't be a long-term goal. I think it could be done from the very beginning. And so this is just my own artistic rendition of how a fairly low-mass centrifuge could be set up at a lunar base.
You have a caller. Do you want to pause and take it?
Yeah, might as well. Go for it.
Hang on. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please? Hello, caller. Are you there? Crap. Hello? Going once, twice, three. Okay. Continue. If he wants or she wants to call back, she's welcome to do so, but I think they probably lay the phone down and then they're not there when we pick it up, so.
Yeah, okay.
Because it wasn't disconnected. I didn't have a dial tone, so they were still on it, yeah.
So the upper right-hand picture of the, is this the third panel? Yeah, third panel, is from the Apollo program showing, you know, why dig when nature's already dug for us? Let's use the existing craters. In the middle left-hand side is just a rendition of sort of what it would be like, the steps in putting the habitat down in the bottom of the crater and then telerobotically beginning to cover it with regolith. Really, the center picture, I've begun to try to look at work that other people have done to figure out how many square feet do you need for greenhouse to support eight people, how many bedrooms, what size should the kitchen and living room, a garage and dirty garage and bathroom and life support areas. And so I've sort of, in a very simplistic format, penciled out how many square feet you need for the different things. The center picture there is sort of describing a term that I've come up with, and that is what I call a unihab. Why drop separate modules and have all the flight and all of the upfront expenses before you can get operations going when inflatables are so thin yet tough? Why not landed all at once in an already integrated format, in a Unihab, so that this thing could be landed, put in a crater, inflated, and you have all of the facilities for a minimalist base right there from the get-go. And then the center right shows some inflatable furniture, so even the furnishings don't necessarily have to be that heavy. And then in the bottom left-hand corner is beginning to deal with the dust issues, and that is, I would say, one of the simpler sort of approaches to prevent dust from sort of sandblasting from the landers is to telerobotically pull out a tarp that would be the target for landing, so it's not blowing dust, abrasive dust all over. And perhaps even the initial roads could simply be tarps to try to keep down the dust. NASA has this really great idea that if you actually have to go outdoors, and I'm with Dr. Logan, who he and I totally agree that as much as possible, keep your crew indoors for both radiation and dust reasons. But if you have to go out, NASA has this concept where you can leave your spacesuits outdoors and not be tracking the dust inside. So, yes, it's carcinogenic, yes, it's abrasive and all these sorts of things, but if you leave it outside, then you don't have to be breathing it indoors.
Of course, all the fun is to go outside. You realize that.
I know. When I mentioned this at the Space Colonization Technical Committee, the chair, she says, "Oh, Doug, you're getting rid of all of the romance of it all." And it's like, well, yeah, but
Well, they can take Dr. Rowe with them for the romance on lunar dust problems as they go out and bask in the solar radiation and sun. Your caller is back. You want to try it again? Hi, caller. Are you with us?
Yeah, but this is a different caller.
Oh, okay. Charles. This is Charles down in Las Vegas. I was about to say Mojave, but you've moved.
Las Vegas, yeah. Ex-Mojave.
Ex-Mojave.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Technical question about this idea of a rover going into a shadowed crater.
Sure.
Is it known now whether the surface of the moon is electrically conductive? In other words, the regolith made of enough glassy-like materials so that the metal-like particles don't connect with one another?
I have not heard anybody discuss that before. That's an interesting question. There is,
and the reason I'm asking it is a rover could lay out thin wires like those of wire-guided guided missiles and go quite some distance, and you can pump a few thousand volts down the wires to run the rover. Otherwise, it'll have to be batteries and get the hell out before the battery goes flat.
So you could do it like a taser, right?
Yeah, taser wires. But I was thinking of wire-controlled missiles, which dates back to World War II.
Are you saying to be able to lay a wire from the rim, the sunlit rim down?
Sure. I mean, missiles work that way.
So help me understand. How does the electroconductivity of the regolith...
Well, that would short-circuit the wires. Wires would be very thin with essentially no insulation. Wire-guided missiles, of course, are laying wires in midair, which is electrically insulating.
So
it was just a thought for a way to power a small rover without having to resort to batteries.
So why would you want to power a small rover?
Well, have it go over into the dark.
In the prospecting mission?
Yeah, or any kind of exploration. Yeah.
Well, I don't like the word exploration because that almost implies a scientific exploration, and I see the Resolve rover doing prospecting, which is it is exploration, but it's specifically to characterize.
Okay. Well,
the resources.
Whatever term you want to use. In any case, there's only a couple of choices. I think nuclear is out of the question because of regulations. So you're left with batteries and having to get the rover out back into sunlight before they go flat, or try to power it by skinny wires.
Yeah. Now, there are some other options that you're not mentioning. So Dr. Woodcock and I are sort of collaborating on a paper, and he is suggesting that you could beam the power with lasers
from the crater rim?
Yeah.
And I said, you're right, that might be a possibility.
But I was concerned about the energy losses when you convert from one form of energy to another.
To convert to fairly high voltage for wire transmission is easy. That could be 90% efficient.
For a wire, that is true, but you can spare the laying of the wire process, which he and I...
Well, that's easy. It just lays it down into the path that is
boring. He and I agree with you. I think that it's a pretty simple and fairly safe solution, but it is the mass of the wire, because it's going to be about 6.5 kilometers on Hinchelwood Crater from...
Yeah. Well, that might be low enough. Missile wires are quite skinny.
Yeah, but you do need to pump quite a bit of power through.
Yeah.
And you're saying that you could use the electroconductivity of the regolith to increase your power?
That would interfere with it.
It would not work if the regoliths were conductive, because that would short current from one wire to the other.
So,
in other words, it must be an insulating regolith, and that was my first question.
Right. Isn't there a really thin paint...
No material will have enough insulation in a very thin layer to withstand much voltage at all. Only a few hundred volts tops. That's not enough.
Then on thin wires, like thin copper wires, what is the coating on that for?
Well, if it's magnet wire, it's just a kind of a form bar, shellac-like material. But
right.
It's only good for a few hundred volts, and that's not nearly enough.
You're pumping thousands of volts through it, so that's why it's not effective.
That's why the regolith itself must be non-conductive.
Yeah,
because it will be lying on it. For a missile, that's not a problem so long as the wires don't touch each other. But I don't know enough about wire-guided missiles to know what voltages they use or whatever. Actually, it's signals that they send on the wire for missiles.
I bet Dr. Spoutis would know.
By the way, am I on the right site? I'm looking at something called Lunar Base 1.
Yeah, with a bunch of pictures?
Yes. Okay, then. All right. It took me a while to get to it.
Yeah.
Okay. I was curious about that little detail. I had been curious about the business of ducking into dark craters, and I didn't see very many practical ways. One way, though, would be to simply see to it that a lithium-ion battery would last long enough to get it in and out.
See, I think for prospecting, maybe that's acceptable, but for actual ice harvesting operations, I would...
Oh, yeah, it definitely would not be, and then you'll need a substantial power source, and that probably means a reactor.
No, I would rather connect by wire, so you could have continuous power.
Than little telephone poles. Yeah, you could do telephone poles.
No, I wouldn't do telephone poles. It all depends on if like you say, if you can have... A wire. I mean,
a telephone pole to have it at least a meter or two above the lunar surface, then it won't matter if it's conductive or not. And telephones, since there's no storms or winds or anything, could be quite skinny little tripods or something.
Yeah, they're superconducting tape, which is, I think, a real possibility.
Well, that's iffy because the temperature restrictions of superconductors. It's unlikely they'll discover a room temperature superconductor anytime soon.
So the superconducting tape would be in the permanently shadowed portions of the path. And the regular wire would be in those
but
portions that would see.
You cannot count on superconductor. Also, they're mechanically rather brittle. The best way is aluminum wire, which is by weight about twice as good a conductor as copper, or, goofy idea, sodium, which is the lightest of all conductors.
Interesting.
In terms of current per pound of weight.
And without oxygen, it would just hang in there for a long time.
Well, in a hard vacuum. But sodium, of course, is mechanically very weak. So the practical solution would be aluminum wire.
What about sodium inside? Sodium on the inside and something else that's more...
Yeah, durable? That would be complicated to engineer. So aluminum would probably be it. But anyway, I'll continue listening and everything. And... the big problem about lunar exploration is transportation.
And I hear you.
Just assuming a Falcon Heavy is not that easy.
So what if a Falcon Heavy flies in 2015?
2015?
It'll be a while before you'll have access to one.
Well, it's going to be a while before this gets funded and the surface hardware is developed. So I think the timing might work fine.
Okay. Well, I think there's a future in doing... lunar exploration with small robotic vehicles first.
Well, Charles, we might get to orbit at least with JP Aerospace, and that would be pretty cheap.
How about micro-launches? That's more practical. Have the doctor look, Google the word micro-launches, and you'll...
You always find a way to work it in, Charles.
Oh, hey. What do you want?
No, even when you're not the guest of honor, you always find a way to work it in.
All right.
Anything else? I'm going to...
That's it. So keep up the good work.
Okay. Right. And I'm going to ping Sputus during the break. Maybe he's available. I'm going to find
all
out
right.
if the lunar regolith is conductive or not. That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's never come up on the show before.
But it is a worthwhile question.
Thank you, Charles. Doug, do you have anything more for Charles?
Just thanks for calling, man.
Yeah. Okay. Bye.
Yeah. David, when you ping him, if you would specifically include the question of would it short a wire, because that's the relevant question here.
Would it short circuit a wire?
Yeah, that's a rather good question that we need to know.
I'll copy you on my note.
Yeah.
You want to take another email? And this is the long winded one I told you about before the show, or do you want to finish this?
Let me just. There's just one more picture that I need to finish, and that is. This bottom, third panel, bottom center is this greenish-yellowish sort of covering.
Uh-huh.
And this is actually a biohazard suit, but the concept would be pretty simple, and that is if you have to go outside and walk around the regolith, you could actually cover your spacesuit with another sort of, what would you call it, a coverall?
Protective coating or something.
Yeah, and then when you get back, you take that off, and your spacesuit is almost spick and span. And then you clean that coverall and reuse it until that, you know, whatever, it doesn't work. And then you put on a new coverall. But the goal should be to try to minimize the number of EVAs.
The phone's ringing again, so...
Okay.
Hold on. I think it's still ringing. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Oh, this is Marshall.
Are you the one who called earlier and got disconnected somehow?
No. This is... Success on the first try.
Okay, go ahead.
Looking these over, I suddenly realized that you have done a significant amount of engineering, and being a computer type, you know, there's checklists and checklists and checklists. It looks like here that you've pretty much started a very complicated checklist of what's needed before you can put a man on the moon in a moon base. Do you have some idea how much water you need and how much radiation protection, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? It just seems like a very interesting checklist to come in there and say, okay, we've got so much food, we've got so much water, we've got a radiation-hardened base, et cetera, et cetera. Have you worked on a checklist like that?
Yes. Well, I've worked on those issues, and other people have worked on them as well. So maybe, do you want me to just go through them one by one? I mean, that
would be interesting. It's just that I realized I'd never seen a checklist before on that particular topic. And first, please talk about it. And second, you might suggest to your friend, hey, put down the checklist and publish it somewhere.
My friend, Dr. Woodcock?
Well, I figure you have dozens of friends, plural.
Okay. Well, let's go through these things that you mentioned. I can recall a couple or three. Radiation, shielding, water, right? And I presume you mean water for hydration and sanitation. Is that correct?
Yes. And I'd also come in there and start thinking about... using it as a fuel, breaking it into oxygen and hydrogen, and, you know, so you have a fuel cell
okay.
fully charged, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, fuel cell for electricity?
Yeah, I figured it'd be an adjunct to the solar panels, and that's another item on the checklist is
how much power. Yeah, so I have, so let me go through these one by one, because these are all obviously things that have to be addressed. And there are things that I have looked into, albeit I looked into it at the level of my capability in that I have biophysics, you know, undergraduate, so that's sort of, you know, many years ago. and then just my self-education. But I have been in touch with the people from Made in Space, electrical engineer, who's going to work with me to clarify some of the electrical issues, and then Dr. Woodcock as well. He and I are going to work through that. So I'm getting some help where I need it. Okay, solar panels is going to be the main source of energy, and there's, I don't know how far to get into this. I mean, there's a lot of technical details in terms of the power density, in terms of the amount of watts per gram of your solar panels, and there's different different solar panels with different specific power. But obviously, we'd need to do to include that into the mass budget. And Marshall, let me sort of explain on the solar power side of things, and that is, I'm actually proposing that you first go not. This doesn't start as a human base. This starts as a teleoperated ice harvesting base for the purpose of producing propellant. And of course, the amount of water you need for propellant is going to dwarf the amount of water that you need for life support. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I totally agree.
Yeah. And yet, the it's one part per 18 is what's in Sabius Crater. And so you don't actually have to harvest that much regolith, you know. And by harvest, I mean steaming it at the location. You're not actually transporting the regolith. And it's fluffy, so you don't have to have heavy equipment. And so you have to harvest 18 times more regolith than you need for propellant, approximately. Mm-hmm. And so the from the electrical power standpoint, the limiting thing is going to be your electrolysis. That's your highest energy demand on the initial operations. Steaming doesn't cost that much. Distillation doesn't cost that much from an energy budget standpoint. But electrolysis is, I think, going to be number one. But the I think it is well worth going for propellant before you go for life support because, first of all, the Falcon Heavy can launch a cryogenic lunar lander, like the Zeus lander, only enough metric tons to the lunar surface to be able to. You can't do a two-way mission with that amount of mass to LEO, if I'm making sense to you, because this is. Falcon Heavy is only about one half, a little less than one half, the capability of the Saturn V. And so you have to send the cryogenic lunar lander to the base, I mean to the lunar pole, and harvest the ice and be able to refuel the lander to be able to initiate a cislunar transportation infrastructure. And then once you get that going, then you can start to think about sending people on the same lander in a crew module. So that's sort of addressing that. I think fuel cells is probably the right choice to get you through the brief lunar night when you're at the peak of eternal light, so I agree with that. For the radiation, I was going to get into that later on the show, but just to explain, according to Dr. Logan, it would be about 7 meters of regolith that you'd need for an RP-100, which is the equivalent of 100% of the shielding that we get from our atmosphere. Because people live in the highest city in the world, La Rinconada, Peru, at I think nearly it's about 17,000 feet, or maybe 16 or 17,000 feet, and yet people grow up, you know, people are born and they grow up and they get married at that altitude. So I'm not convinced we need the full, 7 meters of regolith covering. I think it would be fine, especially initially, to have about half that amount. But just pushing regolith from the rim of the crater onto an inflatable habitat at the bottom is a fairly easy thing to do. And so I would imagine. And so that's the approach that I would use with radiation. And let me mention about radiation is that if for some reason you cannot push enough dirt onto your inflatable habitat before you're ready to send the people, the initial layers of regolith is going to do the most good in terms of reducing your exposure to radiation. And so I think that they could go and stay for a period of 6, 12, or maybe 18 months, and that would give them time, it would buy them time to be able to get the operations working, to be able to continue to push regolith over the inflated habitat so that they can stay for longer and longer periods of time as they get more protection. In terms of the water, if Marshall, are you taking a look at the you are, aren't you, at the picture?
Yeah, I got the pictures right in front of me.
Okay, let me just, in case somebody joined us late, these pictures are at cislunar1.com/base, everything lowercase, and cislunar is cislunarone.com/base. The bottom right-hand picture is life support requirements, and that shows you the amount of kilograms per day per crew member. And it all depends on the nature of the food and whether you're recycling water or not. But if you recycle your water, then you're getting down to about only about 1 kilogram needed per crew per day. And that is a very small amount that I think would be pretty easy to produce from local resources.
Mm-hmm.
And then food? Yeah, I think I sort of addressed food in that thing as well.
Well, you have it in the greenhouse, the picture right above it. You have greenhouse there, so I have to jump on that one.
Oh, yeah. Do you have a question about the greenhouse?
Well, it's kind of like, okay, how much food do you have to show that you can produce before you can, like, open the moon base with, you know, 3 people or 6 people?
So there at the University of Arizona at Tucson, Dr. Giacomelli has been doing studies. If you just do Google Images and type in lunar greenhouse, you can be able to get all sorts of pictures and information about that. But this is, ongoing research, and he's gotten to the point where in a standard greenhouse, which is intended to support a single person, it has enough processing for, I think it's water and air, but only about half the calories, if I'm not mistaken. And they're working to try to get it to where one greenhouse will provide 100% of the calories needed for one person. So based on his numbers, that's how I calculated those. Each square is 1 square meter. That's how I calculated that amount of space.
The next little nuance there is I presume that has to be in a radiation shielded area, and you're using grow lights, bright glow lights.
Absolutely.
Okay. It's kind of like, well, you put it up on the surface, and you know, you get a solar flare, and your popcorn is before you eat it.
There is a possibility you could have light tubes. That's not going to have the radiation, but it will have the sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
But grow lamps are entirely reasonable. Dr. Giacomelli, based on previous studies, says that plants can adequately grow, like annual plants, can adequately grow with 1 meter of regolith on top.
Huh. Okay.
People need more than that, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to dominate the time, but I really enjoy this.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you very much, Marshall.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Listeners, that frees up the line, 866-687-7223, if you want to call in and use the call. So did you finish going through the chart? You got interrupted with these calls.
Yeah, I got through the last picture there with Marshall. So I don't know if you want to ask questions or...
I'm gonna take a break.
Okay.
So, because we're past the point of taking a break, so this is a good point. So, listeners, we're going to pause for a couple of minutes. 1-866-687-7223 is the toll-free number. We do answer the phone during the break. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
David?
Yes.
David? While they're in the break, perhaps people, if they go to cislunar1.com/base, at the very top, there's a hyperlink that says Lunar Base Reference Materials, and that is a Microsoft Word document, which is about 8 megabytes. So if they want to be downloading that, that might be helpful during the break.
Okay, I'm looking at the top. Oh, lunar base of that up in the upper left-hand corner at the top.
Reference materials, yeah.
Okay.
All right.
So, wait a minute. It's saying show all downloads. So you can't open it up. You have to download it. Is that the idea?
It is a Microsoft Word document. So you open it like you're downloading a document.
And it's a Word document, right?
That is correct. Apologize for anybody who doesn't have Microsoft Word.
Well, I do, and I'm still trying to figure out how to work it. We're going to take the break, and
okay. If
I need help, I'll ask you during the break. Listeners, don't go anywhere. Back in a couple of minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody, to part two of our Sunday program. Our guest today, Dr. Doug Plata. We have caller Eric on with us from Florida who has a marginal cell phone, so we're going to do the best here. Hi, Eric. Go for it.
Hi, David. Sorry about the cell phone. Doug, it's a great show. I'm very interested. After your first telerobotic mission,
Ice Harvest.
Deposits some fuel in a depot in Leo. What I don't understand is why you would want to send humans rather than just more robots if they need to be repaired or just swap out modules, or why bother with a human element in that, especially if you're competing against companies that would be entirely telerobotic?
I love the question. It's a great question. My preference would be that with the initial operations, in fact, it would be as telerobotic as possible, preferably 100% telerobotic. There are videos, which means it's a high TR level when you see it with your own eyes, of telerobots, not just the Johnson Space Center's Robonaut 2, but DRL, this is a German space agency. They have a very similar telerobot, and then there's... what is that university on the East Coast? I think Boston. It's slipping my mind, but they have a lab, which they also have a dexterous telerobot, and all of them are shown doing very fine manipulations, sort of teleoperated, where they're doing, you know, connecting wires, and they're doing very intricate sort of stuff. And so I personally believe that telerobots can... If you design the ice harvesting equipment to be easily, you know, swap out parts, I personally have little doubt that telerobots, in fact, can maybe not repair, but they could swap out spare parts. I personally think it's pretty straightforward. So I think that you could keep the ice harvesting operations going completely telerobotically, and you could save a whole lot of money and reduce the risk by doing that. However, when you have lunar landers the size of ULA Masten's Zeus lander, it's large enough to go ahead and put people on the surface of the moon. And I would definitely advocate that because there could be some repairs that maybe need more dexterous control than what a telerobot could do with a three-second delay. But probably ultimately more importantly is there's one thing robots cannot do that people can do, and that is colonize humans throughout the solar system. And so for that reason, I would say use the large landers that you sent the equipment on. After you get the flights, one launch, multiple flights, fairly rapid and low-cost human rating of the lunar landers. When you get it safe enough to send people, you send people on those same landers. I hate to say this, but sort of send them as cargo, because I think automated landings are probably the safest.
Yeah, definitely.
And then, but before they land, you have the landers go and send the inflatable habitats and the greenhouse and these sorts of things, life support equipment, and even provisions, so that when the humans arrive, it's as much of a turnkey operation as possible. So they walk in, hopefully it's already shielded, hopefully plants are already growing, because the telerobots can do some of that stuff. So they walk in, and from the very get-go, the goal of this base is for the crew to stay there for as long as possible. And this is where providing artificial gravity and radiation shielding comes in. And have them stay as long as possible for a couple reasons. One is it simply costs a lot of money to rotate crew, and so the fewer crew you have to send back, the less crew you have to send to replace them. So it's helping to significantly reduce the cost if they can stay for a long time. And then second of all is when you are able to access local resources, you are really beginning to be in a situation where you can seriously consider this permanent base becoming the first off-Earth settlement. And I think that having settlement in space is a laudable long-term goal. And if you are providing your own life support from local resources, I think that it's maybe not so long-term. Perhaps it's nearer than most people recognize.
Okay. Well, the telerobotic ice harvesting idea is just fantastic and very exciting. What kind of worries me is that the time frame for human presence on the moon would start to overlap with SpaceX's initiative to colonize Mars, and that even precursor non-perishable cargo missions to Mars would begin launching while you're launching humans to the moon or developing a lunar base. And so it could divert resources and attention and so on from a destination that really might be much more suited for civilization, you know, an entire second branch of civilization. Is that at all a concern, or does that make sense?
Not really. In the first place, I would say, are we going to settle just one destination?
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah. I mean, the moon is a legitimate destination in its own right, and people need to understand this. It's not like, oh, now that we're going to Mars, let's stop going to the moon. No, the moon is a comparison. It's a less expensive, sort of safer, short distance away. It's three distance, you know. And if you need to come back because of some sort of medical emergency, it's safer as well. And the key thing to remember, people look at this almost ocean's worth of ice on Mars. It's sort of irrelevant in comparison to the moon, because the moon has nowhere near the amount of water, but it has way more than you need to support an initial base. And
sure.
Concentrations that are quite high. So I really emphasize the moon is a legitimate destination, and in my opinion, I think Elon Musk notwithstanding, the establishing a lunar base is going to cost less money, and so I don't see why we need to hold off on doing that. Now, the funding is probably going to be different between the two. And incidentally, I absolutely support the establishment of Mars Base as well. And I would even go so far as to say we should also establish a Deimos and a Phobos base, and even perhaps beyond, and O'Neillian habitats. There's some interesting low cost things that can be done there as well with inflatables. I think there's no reason to play one off the other.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. It sounds like a moon and Mars sort of approach.
If you're going to Mars, wouldn't you want to put an habitat, it be inflatable to make it easy, and put it in a crater on Mars and cover it over? And wouldn't you want centrifuges to get from 3/8 gravity to whatever the gravity prescription is? In other words, wouldn't we want to apply the same lessons learned at one place at the other place?
Whichever comes first. That's the problem right now. We're facing a budgetary crisis again, and have to make a decision between the two, or whatever. I guess we'll see in the future.
I think what I'm describing to establish a lunar base is an important backup, because we don't know Elon's plans, so it's really hard to judge as to how realistic it is to go, to go to Mars. We don't know the time frame. Well, he's given some ideas, but we don't have any way to assess whether it's realistic or not, because we don't have the details. But also, the big rocket, the BFR or Mars Colonial Transport, we don't know if that's going to have any commercial value. And so is it going to be able to be financially supportable? I would say we don't know. Whereas we do know that the Falcon Heavy is likely to be financially supportable because it's based on the Falcon 9 cores. And the Falcon 9 cores certainly look financially supportable because of the large manifest that it has. So I'm describing a way to get to the moon with more proven launcher technology than what we don't know about, which is Elon's, the financial viability of Elon's big rocket, which we know precious little about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's a consideration, I guess. I appreciate the show, and thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure, good to meet you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Listener, that opens up the line again, 866-687-7223. You have a note from, you have a lot of notes here. Bijan in Sweden, what is the main difference between your concept and that of Dr. Spudis, the one that he has outlined for returning to the moon? And have a look at wireless microwave power transfer. Forget about dragging cables around on the moon. Regards, Bijan.
I'm agnostic. I would let the electrical engineers do the trade studies to find out what is the best way. So Bijan might be correct about that. I don't know enough to be able to say. What was his first question?
What's the difference between what you and Spudis outline?
Spudis is $87 billion. Mine is about $17.7 billion. Spudis will not consider the cost savings of a Falcon Heavy. I do. Spudis's approach assumes Atlas launchers, which are smaller, whereas my concept can achieve the same goals with fewer launches and hence less cost. Fewer cost and less cost per launch. And he has more, he includes a prospecting mission, whereas I assume that that's already going to be done by the time my concept gets going. I presume that Resolve will be the prospecting mission, and there could be some follow-on prospecting missions. Spudis also has, in his plans, multiple sizes of lunar landers, and I just go with the large lander from the get-go because it's already highly developed. The Centaur upper stage is developed and used and operational. And there's some other things, but those are the main differences.
Okay, you have another caller on the line.
Okay.
Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you?
This is John Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
Hey, John.
Yeah, Okay. First of all, I think this is that's a very excellent work here. So this is nice. What I do think that a couple of things that need to be thought about is, well, okay, we're going to transport water from the moon back to Earth orbit, but we have to have a customer. First of all, we'd have to have an orbital depot system in orbit, which not only can store, the propellants, but actually do the processing to turn them into cryogenic propellants of hydrogen and oxygen. That'd be one thing. And the other thing is we'd have to have a customer for that hydrogen and oxygen, some sort of other space program that would require those quantities of propellant.
Okay, I got four things there, which I've written down. John, I think you're making a lot of assumptions about my proposed architecture, which are not actually what I'm proposing. So let me sort of go through them. First of all, you mentioned water to Earth orbit. I'm proposing that we do this in steps and take the easiest steps first. And returning water to low Earth orbit is not the easiest step. I think delivering water to low lunar orbit is going to be easier because you don't have to deal with aerobraking. It's a smaller delta V, and it's within a single flight of a refueled lunar lander. So what would be the value of water at low lunar orbit? What I would like to propose is that if this is a lunar COTS program and NASA is putting up the funding, that they recognize that shielding for interplanetary missions, shielding being water, is a value to them and the international community. So I would, if it were my design of funding program, I would have a milestone be the delivery of water to low lunar orbit up to about 80 tons of water, which is actually pretty doable, I believe. And then after you do that, then you use your cryogenic reusable lunar lander to dock with that water that you put up in bags and actually go ahead and push that up into like EML2 or perhaps even a double synodic Earth-Mars orbiting orbit in order to have a reusable shielded craft that cycles between Earth and orbit that you could use, launch once, but use multiple times. But you are correct that eventually the goal would be to return to Earth orbit, but it's not necessarily true that, if possible, I would recommend not transporting water to low Earth orbit, but rather delivering propulsion service to low Earth orbit and to skip the propellant depot at LEO. And the way that this works is if you have a propellant depot at EML2, or if you use a buddy lander system where you launch two landers from the lunar surface, they dock, like in low lunar orbit, and one pushes the other so that the lander ends up in a trans-Earth injection path without having used anything except the propellant to get up to low Earth orbit. And then they detach. The one that expended the propulsion loops around, does a circum-Earth path back towards the moon and uses a little bit of propellant to get back to the lunar surface. Whereas the other lander has enough propellant to be able to aerobrake and be able to provide propulsion service in any inclination from the very get-go so that you're able to serve customers at in any orbital inclination because you're coming from such a great distance and you're going like from EML2 or you're passing through EML2 and you can do those high inclination plane changes. So you might have some comments about that if you understood what I was saying. Orbital depots, cryogenic. So the nice thing is in the permanently shadowed lunar craters, you have ambient, you have natural cryogenic temperatures as low as 33 Kelvin. And so I would say have your fuel depot on the lunar surface as much as possible. And you may even have only not hydrogen up in orbit, but maybe just liquid oxygen, which is easier to maintain in an orbital depot. And you do sort of just-in-time launching from the moon when your customer is about to launch from Earth into an orbit, your lunar lander leaves the moon and arrives in the orbital inclination that the customer is going to be at just prior to when they launch, and so that their propulsion is already in orbit waiting for them to launch. And then they launch, and then our craft docks with them, pushes them up to GEO or wherever. And so you have relatively short amount of time for boil-off, whereas if you have a fuel depot in LEO, it may be up there months before you have having to store it in the temperature of the sun at the distance of the Earth. And then you mentioned customers. I think this is very analogous to the current public-private programs. The anchor tenant is NASA, and it will be NASA for a very long time. But they are the anchor tenant. You start getting customers other than NASA as well. That can be other countries. They would certainly, a lot of European countries and others, they would like to go to the moon. And here now you're having a cislunar transportation infrastructure in place that is able to deliver scientific equipment, cargo, and eventually people to the lunar surface. And so I think it could support an international lunar base quite well. But also there is a whole slew of orbital service that you could provide, both boosting as well as pushing junk, dead satellites into the junk orbit and deorbiting large junk, as well as boosting from LEO to GEO, interplanetary science probes pushed into those trajectories, circumlunar tourism and lunar surface tourism as well, as well as some other things. So it would be a stepwise. Those customers and those markets wouldn't exist immediately, but once you have a truck in space, it really opens up a lot of possibilities.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, but my point is that you have to have a customer. I mean, what I'm saying is that this program as a COTS type program, right?
Right.
Which will have a joint funding. The idea is a shared funding with a private company and NASA or the government in some way.
That is correct.
Okay. Well, but to launch a program like that, for instance, the one we had for the, we already had a space station up there, and we were retiring the shuttle, so we needed a transportation system mm-hmm. to bring up cargo and eventually now crew to the space station. So we had a customer in place already. I mean, this needs to be developed, I would think, with a view of some customer, initial customer or customers, plural, that would utilize this, is what I'm saying, that's what I was really trying to get at. Okay, you have some other interesting ideas of how to utilize it, but my point still comes back. Right now, there's no customer for it, really.
Well, you agree NASA would be the anchor tenant, so there is a customer.
Yeah, yes, absolutely, but they're not. But they don't have a program yet that would utilize it, and so this would have to, would seem to me, be done in parallel with some other program or programs that would utilize it. Then it becomes a very attractive idea of how to make those other programs more economical.
I understand. So basically what I'm saying is the reason why we don't have a program to go to the moon, I mean, if this was during the Constellation days, then we would have a program. So having a program is a policy decision. And so I'm basically saying we need to put the moon back in America's space policy, and it should be a public-private approach as opposed to the way Constellation was done, which is only a government approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. I mean,
remember, Bigelow's customer, his first customer will be international, you know, sovereign clients. It's going to be international countries who say, we would like a cheap access to a space station. And those people will be his first customers. And I imagine an international lunar base, I think there would be a lot of support in the international community for that. And so that would also represent an early customer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, all right, so, but to get to the lunar base, you're going to fuel in from the moon? I guess there's so many different options out there, I was just kind of...
Yeah.
Well,
the way to think about it is the harvesting the ice at the poles of the moon and producing propellant is a way to get the landers back off the moon. So it's a gas station on the moon. And so you complete this, the circuits that you can do in cislunar space by having return propellant that you don't have to deliver, you know, launch and deliver from Earth.
Okay, that would be true. Well, the other thing is that while the propellant site would be largely at the poles, I would think that other than that, I would think that more a lot of the other interesting locations would be other places on the moon, right? I mean,
so the lunar lander could be a ballistic hopper. And you could access, you could do incredible amount of geologic studies at Spudis's most favored list of places that he wants to get samples, and you could hop about five or six times at about 10 degrees each hop and make it back to the poles to refuel. And so you could do some incredible exploration of the moon once you get this truck available.
Yeah. That makes some sense. Well, I just was trying to explore some of those ideas. It looks to me like that this is something, though, that again, is primarily interesting if there's some other programs out there that currently don't exist. But it would be an enabler to those programs if somebody were planning them. It would make them more economical to do by a long ways, potentially.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a good proposal to have on the table and to have people discussing.
And that's the other part. I'm trying to interact with NASA and even interact with Congress and trying to interact with the whoever. I guess it's not going to be Romney, but whoever the space advisors for the campaigns might be, to try to say, hey, this is an option if we were to choose this option.
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, that does make some sense for a lot of possibilities. I mean, like I say, the kind of lunar exploration you're talking about, if you could, you know, base there and return based on local propellant. That would certainly make a lot of sense. Well, thanks a lot. I just wanted to kind of explore some of those ideas and how you were thinking about utilizing it.
Sure. Thanks for calling, John.
Listeners, the line is available, 866-687-7223. You have another email from Sweden. Can you have Earth in line of sight from the same place on the lunar pole where you have near 100% sunlight? Or would your mission have to start with a multi-billion-dollar investment in several lunar orbiting comm satellites for your polar telerobotics?
Okay, I think I understand. David, do you understand this question?
Yeah. How are you going to communicate with your robots? Will you have line of sight with Earth, or do you going to have to put up a lot of communication sats?
Okay, it's a great question. In my mind, there's two options. One option is, on the first mission on the way to the moon, you can drop off a set of orbiting satellites around the moon in the polar orientation at 86 degrees, and that is actually a stable low lunar orbit. And so I would set out about four or five satellites that would allow continuous line of sight between Earth and the deep parts of the lunar poles. So that's one option. I think that there's another option. I've seen some work on this, but I can't definitively explain, but there are certain peaks and there's certain choice of landing site that gives you a good view of the Earth, and yet at that site you can also go through some repeaters on the surface to be able to make the connections down to your work site. But the bottom of the craters are fairly visible to the rims. And so I think that through two repeaters or something like this, I think you should be able to establish a connection to the Earth.
Okay. And you have another caller on hold.
And then dial your operator.
I guess you don't have another caller on hold. They hung up. So your call, the number, listeners, is 1-866-687-7223. It's already ringing again. Let's try again. Hello, caller. Who are you? Where are you? Somebody really doesn't know how to work their phone. Hello. Going once, twice. You're out of here. If you're the same person, you really don't know how to work your phone. I don't know. Look up the manual. I don't, it might be a telemarketer, and, you know, they, I don't know. Anyway, Now it's ringing again. Let's see if it's the same person. Hello, caller, are you there? So I think someone may be on the moon just playing with us from the moon. Caller, are you there? Well, I disconnected them, so I don't know who's, I don't know what the problem is, and they're not sending an email. So if they call again and have, I'll tell them to send an email. Doug, your engineering, your design, your equipment, your ideas, your concept—that's one thing. So if you got 5 minutes in front of the House Science and Technical Committee and another 5 minutes in front of the Senate Committee, how would you persuade them that this is important to do as a public-private partnership or for any amount of public money? How would you convince them to do it? Because they don't care about the technology. They'll work all that out or delegate it to NASA or to Boeing or to who, Timbuktu or whatever. But you got to persuade them to cut loose with the purse strings and do it. So how do you persuade them? You got a 5-minute testimony before each body of Congress. How do you do it?
So, I mean, you're asking me on the spot for some sort of Neil deGrasse Tyson sort of speech.
Well, he didn't succeed, so I'm not asking you for Neil deGrasse, because his plan didn't work. You know, they blew him off, too.
Yeah, I know. But he's asking for more money, and I'm
yeah,
not...
Yeah, he was
I'm
doubling the... He wanted to double the NASA budget to 1%, but he thought he had a really good, compelling reason why they should do that, and I actually liked his reason. But they obviously Congress didn't like it.
So, you know, so I would need to think about it and write up something and run it past people and try to get the best thing as possible. But just to sort of run with it, so just off the top of my head, some points that I think would be made to policymakers. You have to tailor the message to the audience. And so what is it that interests them? There is a decent amount of support, a surprising amount of support, funding support. By Congress for NASA, even though it may be ranked really low on their political list, that somehow that translates into if you take a look at NASA's budget since the Apollo era, and you adjust it for inflation, Congress and the administration has basically maintained about 2/3. Of the equivalent of NASA's budget during the Apollo program. So I feel as though they are, you know, committing and sustaining a fairly decent size space program. I don't believe that it's necessary to expand NASA's budget. I think that with the COTS approach, which is now proven, that we can accomplish remarkable goals in space by using this approach, and I think the next logical step is to do a lunar COTS approach. And I would say that it, you know, the less that it costs to achieve something, the stronger the arguments become for doing the program. Let me give this illustration, David. David, if I were to ask you, hey, wouldn't you enjoy going to Tahiti? You would say, yeah, that would be cool. I say, okay, let's go. And you say, well, no, I don't think so. I say, well, why not? Well, you know, it's going to cost, you know, $2,000 or something to go. And I say, oh, forgive me, David. I have a card, you know, it's a Fly Tahiti Visa card, and I've built up points, and I have enough to be able to have two Tahiti packages that includes the flights, the hotel, and a little tour. And so I have two of these, and if I don't use them up in the next couple of months, I'm going to lose them. So, David, will you go with me to Tahiti? Well, that totally changes the scenario because it went from $2,000 down to $40 to drive from the airport to the hotel and back. And so what happens is whatever motivation that you had before, which was not sufficient to go with the program, is now sufficient because the cost is low. And so really, it is a comparison of cost and benefit rather than just the benefits, making the case based on benefits. And what I'm proposing here is a remarkably low-cost approach to establishing something I think is really valuable, and that is a permanent base off Earth, the first permanent base, human base,
basically the first human step into the solar system. For Congress, I would also say, because I think this is something that is of interest to many of them, and that is I would basically say that if we don't do this, if we delay another 4 years, then that historic moment of the first establishment of the first human presence off Earth, like a base, is going to go to some other country. And I think I know which country that's going to be. And so the question is, do we want history to record that it was a free country, America, that led the way to moving people off Earth, or do we want to leave that to some other country? And I'm not asking for a doubling of NASA's budget. I'm not even asking for an increase of NASA's budget. I think that modifying a Centaur upper stage could be done for within $400 million. The terrestrial demonstrator, Dave Masson, said that it can be done for $50 million. And so it seems to me as though if we can just get LunarCot started, I think that it will catch on, and we will see real progress, and then it's going to be sustainable, and because it's going to lower the cost by accessing off-Earth resources. So I don't know if that's the best way of making the argument, but that's right off the top of my head, that would be the argument that I'd make.
All right, so we have a caller on hold. Let's see if this one goes through. Caller, are you there?
Yeah, hi, David and Doug. This is Rasmus Kier from Toronto.
Okay.
And great show. It's interesting that you mentioned David Masten and the Centaur upper stage modification. He was just on the TMRO show yesterday, and they talked about that possibility. So maybe check it out. I was the caller, actually, who called in recently at the very end of the recent Pulse Buddhist show. And I mentioned the idea to cover a crater, an ice-filled crater, with mylar. And I sent in by email. Actually, I tried to call. I didn't make it through. Mylar is really very highly reflective, and it's often used in emergency situations to keep people warm, things like that. And so the idea would be pick a small crater, and that crater could no longer radiate its heat out into space, and it would slowly warm up, and the ice would start to sublimate. And then somehow there, one could use a way to condense that water. I suggested a compressor, and then pipe it in and make it liquid. If that internal heat or is not enough, then one could potentially use something like fiber optics also instead of electricity to pipe in some additional heat. And that was the idea. I think Pulse Buddhist liked the idea. It would get around the problem of using equipment in the very deep, very cold temperatures.
What is your name?
Rasmus.
What is that?
Rasmus, R-A-S-M-U-S.
Okay, Rasmus. I remember your call. I was just astounded with, if you don't mind my saying, the brilliance of it. And I remember you asked Dr. Spudis regarding the feasibility of it, what's the likelihood of that small craters would also contain these volatiles? And he said that he thought that it might, in fact, be the case. Do you recall that?
Yeah, he said that. It doesn't work with a big crater, Shackleton or whatever, but with a smaller crater, say something like a 100-meter crater that might work.
Yeah, so I've even thought about how would you pull the mylar over it, how do you unfold and unroll, and I've actually, because of your call, actually have looked around on Google Images to see if I could see an example of tarps being unrolled by robots. I have not been able to see anything like that, but it seems to me actually rather doable. And then I recall that you mentioned, which I think makes sense, that you'd also have, as it's being unrolled, you'd have like another robot that's pushing regolith over the edges to sort of secure it and also seal it.
One might take two rovers and first roll it out, and then take two rovers at the same time that drive on you know, opposite sides of the crater.
Right.
Take like a square shaped piece of mylar, and that should do it. And then one would just have to cover the edges of the mylar, and then it would be sealed, and it couldn't evaporate out into space.
Yeah, yeah. frankly, I think that is in the realm of, it's in the trade space, and I think if that is possible at this moment in time, I'm thinking that might actually be the preferred approach. And you're right, it would get around the intricacies and the complexities of the rovers working in the cryogenic temperatures.
And I think the use of fiber optic lighting is really interesting, not just for this application, but also for others, like using just lighting in habitats for greenhouses, all kinds of things. So this way the greenhouse wouldn't be exposed to any radiation, and you mentioned earlier that plants don't care that much, but still, it would be... fiber optic lighting is becoming more and more popular for housing applications here on Earth, but it would be really fantastic to use that on the moon.
So, Rasmus, I guess right off the top of my head, I would wonder, why not drive a rover just into the edge of the crater before you cover it, and then that thing has basically a focused microwave beam that beams down into pretty much any part of the floor of this small crater with highly concentrated energy that starts steaming out the volatiles.
I think technically a bit more complicated, because then you convert energy, you could take sunlight, turn it into microwaves, and instead of doing that, you could just use, focus the panel onto the, not solar panel, but actually the light collectors.
Okay.
Onto
like
the
mirrors.
Sun, and then just pipe that light directly.
I'm wondering, are the fiber optics going to just spray the light out so that by the time it hits the bottom of this crater, that it's going to be fairly diffuse and may not cause it to...
But you could put the pipe all the way down to the ice.
But how do you move it around?
That's an issue. I guess you could pull and push it, but
move it around. Yeah, that's interesting.
A couple other things. I think you mentioned earlier the possibility of using a crater that already exists to build inflatables. The downside with that is that it would make it a little more difficult to expand the base later. So if you use flat terrain and you build it on flat ground, then you could always, remove the some of the regolith at the edges, and then just keep building new inflatables next to it. But if it's in a crater, there might be bedrock. So, just maybe a downside.
Yeah, that's fair. I guess I make a distinction between an initial base where you're trying to do things low cost and as safe as possible. So it may not be the ideal for the long term, but it's safest and to do it this way, I think.
One more suggestion for inflatables: the possibility of building an internal geodesic dome. That's actually a really lightweight way to achieve a lot of strength. On the recent show with Dr. Benaroy, he talked about some concepts using glue and things like that to strengthen the inflatable after inflation. But I guess that would require humans to kind of build an internal geodesic dome with perhaps aluminum struts or something like that.
Yeah, so again, I make a distinction between an initial base and a later base.
Yeah, sure.
I think Benaroy was talking about it later.
That would probably require humans to set up the dome. I get it.
Well, I mean, you can inflate a dome. There's a huge dome over in London called the Millennium Dome, and it's externally supported, which is an interesting design concept. So I think that you could have a really huge dome that would require minimal construction. I think.
Yeah.
And frankly, if you understand that we have 14.7 psi air pressure at sea level because of the weight of this air above us that also doubles as shielding for radiation, then that shows you how much weight you could support within a lunar inflatable. And it is enough pressure pushing up that you could have the full weight that you need for radiation of regolith on top of it, and it's still going to be inflated. So the danger is what if you lose your airlock, and you have this mass coming down on you because the base is deflating. So I think that there is a need to support it, but it doesn't necessarily have to be metal ribs or really heavy sort of stuff that's going to require masonry or anything like this. I think that there can be some easier ways to provide that protection for support. And my thought is probably the easiest way is just to have poles that are providing vertical support in case it's ever needed, and then you connect these poles to each other using wires to sort of a crisscross pattern to make it a solid sort of support.
I don't want to hog the line too long, but just one more thing about what you said about delivering water or delivering propellant from the moon. What about delivering only hydrogen? Is that a problem with too much boil-off in the 3 days or so it takes to get to LEO? Split the water on the moon and only deliver the hydrogen, keep the oxygen on the moon, and then deliver the oxygen in some other way. There's some concepts, not very developed, but interesting, of scooping up oxygen from the upper atmosphere in LEO. This was kind of a 1960s concept, but basically forgotten. It's the so-called PROFAC idea that I think was classified for some time and not really developed further. But if boil-off is not too much of a problem in the trip from the moon to the Earth, then that might be a good way to save on weight, keep the oxygen on the moon.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never heard this concept before. I'm skeptical on first hearing of it, but I haven't thought about it much.
Yeah,
at all.
It certainly is going to need some more development.
Okay, I want to clear up the line. Anything
sure.
else?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah, bye.
Bye. You have an email I've been sitting on from Adrian in San Diego. I think he's in San Diego. A possible alternative to the use of solar panels for production of electricity on the KBS crater would be the use of high-efficiency Stirling engine generators. Their compactness and ease of deployment would simplify the installation. Available there are both components needed, almost perpetual sunlight, thus heat, and the perpetual darkness and extreme cold needed for the Stirling cycle.
So I'd like to ask Adrian if he could email in. Could he explain a little bit more about how the energy gets into the Stirling engines? Is there parabolic mirrors or exactly how this would work? Because I don't know right offhand. Do you, David?
No.
Okay. Hopefully Adrian will
no,
email back.
Hopefully he's still listening. He emailed us at the end of last segment. So
that's an alternate to solar panels. Wow. This is great stuff.
I'll forward you his email and you'll have his address.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great. But if he could email in during the show so we can all get the answer.
He may not be listening anymore. As I said, he emailed us the first segment, and I'm only getting around to his email now. You have another caller.
Okay.
Hi, caller, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And, okay, so go ahead.
This is Tim?
Yeah, it's Tim.
Yeah, this is Tim from Huntsville. Oh, are you the one I talked to about the about how would you service a rocket on a lunar base?
I sort of remember this.
Yeah, I was wondering if you looked into it.
I apologize. I don't think I have, but I can give some thoughts off the top of my head here. Let me make sure I understand the question, and that is, the lunar landers are going to need servicing, and servicing generally requires people. And so how can you keep these things running? Is that your question?
Yeah, how to keep them running.
Okay. Again, I make a distinction between initial operations and later operations. Initial operations, I think it is fine to let things run until they break down. And the reason for that is a couple reasons. Number one is right now we have extremely expensive transportation systems, so anything that can reduce the cost helps. And I'm talking about, you know, like if you have an RL-10 engines or these other like X-Cores, smaller engines, these things start and restart, start and stop. For I know the RL-10 on one mission did it like 7 or 8 restarts, and some of these engines can basically go on, you know, almost forever, starting and restarting, like X-Cores engines. So if you can launch once and get, you know, 5, 10, 15 flights before it breaks down, that right there is a pretty significant savings. And so for the early term, I would say we don't need perfect reusability. We can get away with moderate reusability to where we get multiple flights out of a single launch. So it's not so urgent immediately. Second point is that it depends on where the craft break down. And we're talking about in the early term in which there's not maintenance being done. So if it breaks down in orbit, it's going to stay in orbit, and that asset, the value of that asset, is not necessarily lost. It could be pushed to the International Space Station. It could be pushed to EML-1 or whatever, and it could be pushed to a place to where later people can access it, fix things, you know, switch out engines or some sort of servo or whatever, and be able to redeem the value of it at a later time. If for some reason it were to break down, obviously if it were to crash on the lunar surface, then that's like a total loss probably. You might be able to get some parts, but by and large it's a loss. What's that?
I think you'd be better off if they took the approach that SpaceX did, use multiple rockets that you could throttle up if some of the engines fail, and then go and make it orbit and take it apart, take off the engines that don't work, and then put on new ones.
That is interesting. So on the Zeus lander, there's the main engine, which is the RL-10. And then there's the Mastin modified. If you were to have two Mastin engines per corner, so you have a total of 8, then what happens is while it's in the process of landing or taking off, if one engine breaks down, you still have a backup engine on that corner, in which case it's exactly what you're talking about. It doesn't crash, and later you could go ahead and replace that part. What I would do in the early years is I would go ahead and design it so that those external engines for, you know, the landing, for the horizontal landing, would be modular so that they could be swapped out by the telerobots, the dexterous telerobots. And that's part of the spare parts that you send to the moon are those small engines that you may need to keep things going. Tim, that's a pretty good suggestion I hadn't thought about.
Yeah. Okay, there's another thing. Let's see how I put this. I had a friend of mine, and we had a bit of a disagreement on whether we should go to the moon or go to the asteroid belt and mine. I felt like the moon was better because you can get there in about 3 days. It's easier to service, and you can always put up a mass driver to launch the payloads. Do you have anything else you could add to that argument, or would you be kind of okay with either one?
It's an interesting question. I have been I'm not as strongly against asteroids as I was initially, as I've learned more, in particular when Planetary Resources came out with their concept of bagging and bringing back an asteroid to cislunar space to where it's within telerobotic reach. that addressed what used to be one of my largest objections to asteroids, and that is you can't do teleoperations when you're like 8 to 20 minutes, you know, time delay. When I saw them suggest the idea in their initial video about bagging and bringing it back, it sort of addressed that issue in a way that I simply hadn't thought about. But what I would say is the reason why I'm still a moon first person instead of asteroid first is almost, you know, how can I say this? Nobody really makes the argument that asteroids are the first place that we should establish settlement. The moon has so much immediate resources, and the ice is, you know, relatively easy to access. We know the concentration, we know where it is, and the process of steaming it out of the regolith should be pretty straightforward. That it seems to me as though, in order to establish a lunar base that can supply its own life support in the near term, it seems to me as though the moon is a fairly known thing, and it already is close. We don't have to bring the moon into cislunar space. It's already there, whereas asteroids take that extra step. I personally think, although I know that Chris Lewicki disagrees with this, or I'm sorry, one of the other guys at Planetary Resources, but I think that a bit of gravity is helpful in processing these things. The asteroid people say zero gravity might actually be preferential over 1/6 gravity. For me, I think having some gravity that you can drive around in and move stuff easily is advantageous. But for me, ultimately comes down to an issue of the earliest possible settlement, and I think the moon wins because of the closeness of the resources. And also, I'd add telerobotics from the Earth. You could have an expanding telerobotic workforce on the moon, even using in-situ metals for the bulky metal parts of the telerobots. But you have people doing shifts on the moon, you know, three eight-hour shifts, so that you have 24/7 harvesting of ice on the moon. And so from a economic standpoint, I think that there is a strong case that we could be able to produce a significant amount of propellant and propulsion service based on lunar operations, whereas right now, without more explanation of how they could get access to that much water so easily, I don't know how you can make that case with asteroids. Tim?
Hello?
Tim, are you
there? Oh, yeah, I'm listening.
Well,
I'm there.
Wind it up because other callers want to get in. And
no, I'm done.
Okay. Oh. Thank you, Tim. Appreciate your call. Okay, so listeners, if you want to get in, we're 8 minutes away from the end of the show, which will end at 2 p.m. It's not such a great idea to go beyond 2 hours. The call number is 1-866-687-7223. What's next for you, Doug?
Yeah, let me mention something I probably should have mentioned before, and that is I have been asked to organize for the Space Access Conference, which is coming up, I think it's April 20, if I'm not mistaken, in Phoenix. And I think a lot of us are very excited that SpaceX Conference is starting up again. It's almost a favorite conference for many of us. But I've been asked to organize a COTS 2 return to the moon section or track. And so I've committed to doing that, and I'm going to be working with Henry Vanderbilt as I arrange some speakers at that conference to be able to discuss different aspects about return to the moon. And so I would like to encourage people to go to, David, do you know, is it space-access.com?
Something like, I don't know it by heart. But
let's see if we can confirm that, or if Henry's listening.
I think that is what it is.
I'll try to confirm it here right now. But anyhow, if you want to learn about the conference, and I'd like to invite you to join us there, it should be a grand time, go to the website, and you can keep up to date as to the progress as it's coming along. And what I'd also say, David, is if you wanted Henry to come on the show before the SpaceX conference, I think he would really jump at that opportunity.
Yeah, he comes on all the time. He and I are always in touch. So
okay.
Yeah, it is space-access.org. Listen to me, .org.
Okay.
And it's a weird website, so listeners don't think you're going to get to any kind of fancy conference website, because that's just not it at all. But it'll start out with Space Access Society, and it's kind of a bluish gray background, and you'll know that you're there. But what I would do, rather than if you're interested in this, rather than depend on going to the website, go down to the bottom and sign up for his newsletter and email reports, because he gives everything out by email and is very, very good at keeping people updated on not just the conference, but on issues that are relevant to the Space Access Group. And you can give him your email address. You'll see it down at the bottom. It says email us, and you'll get on that list, and that's the best way to stay involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, you know, Space Access back issues. Well, that just really means those email updates that I'm talking about. So, you know, you can go see the December 14th updates, November 14th updates. These are all things that he emails out to people. So it's much easier that way than to always remember to go to the website. Are you signed up for his emails, Doug?
Actually, I don't think I am.
So it's space.access@space-access.org. Or if you know Henry's private email address, which you do, just email him and ask him to put you on the list.
Okay. David, let me maybe discuss a little bit more about the artificial gravity. I made mention of it, but I don't think I've done it justice.
Okay.
I had a chance this last week to speak with a professor at the University of Maine about this large sort of donut-shaped inflatable that NASA donated to them. And actually, for the listeners, if you would, again, go to cislunar1.com/base, and the upper left-hand, there's a link to a document with a lot of pictures. It's going to take a little bit to download, but it's cislunar1, with one spelled out, .com/base, and click on that link. In the link, it's a Microsoft Word document, and it is page number 1, 2, 3, 4. Let me mention on page number 5, the inflatables. Inflatables are not some weird concept. They are TRL-9 in space, and that there's a couple of inflatables already flying. So I think it's very advanced technology, and there's a lot of pictures of a lot of NASA and other people who are looking at using inflatables for a base. And I would just add that, David, your university, UND, actually shows a very large inflatable, which I think is still low mass there. So in speaking with Dr. Abedi at University of Maine, I came across some pictures and work that they had done with NASA's inflatable sort of article there. And I began doing some calculations and came to the realization that actually going through a step of short-arm centrifuge may not be necessary in a base. We may be able to go with long arm and be able to get the full additional gravity, artificial gravity, that is needed for full health from the gravity standpoint. And I've done calculations of the diameter that would be needed for the long arm centrifuge. And there is a picture on page 9. In the middle picture is a picture of a centrifuge at a NASA center at NASA Ames. And this is a fairly low-mass centrifuge that is about, I think, 17 meters in radius. And that can get up to 1G, a full G of artificial gravity. And yet that is a little bit bigger than the inflatable at the University of Maine, but if that inflatable were to be expanded somewhat, it could actually be able to house the a full-size centrifuge. And so I think that there is now a possibility that you could actually provide the crew at a lunar base with full artificial gravity and address some of those issues. What I would say is that it's the RPMs, it's what comes down to the fundamental question. And as I've looked into it, I know as Al Globus have looked into it, there are some studies indicating that crew that can accommodate to it, which we can test for, are able to handle up to 5.4 RPMs, which is generally considered fairly high. But in the studies, most of those that could accommodate, in fact, did accommodate to that for, I think, even weeks at a time. If that is true, if that bears out, then I think that we can fit a long-arm centrifuge within an inflatable from the get-go.
Okay. Is this doctor at Maine attempting to test any of this?
Not the centrifuge. He's electrical engineering, and so he was working with the inflatable to embed a lot of sensors to be able to tell temperatures in different parts, humidity, and also if there was any puncture that the sensors would be able to detect where the puncture is. But as I spoke with him about these additional ideas, he is interested to see if there might be a like an RFP, request for proposal, that would address some of these things. As far as I know, that's not NASA's priority during this administration. But if there was a serious return to the moon part of America's space policy, then I think that this funding for this sort of research could become available.
Did you, by the way, ever reach Lori Garver?
No, I want to do my homework before I do that.
Okay, and is there anything new on your other events that you've talked about that you want to get in before the show ends?
Yeah, so David has been aware, and I have been a little hesitant to say too much because it's preliminary at this point, but I'm wanting to – this technical ideas are one thing, but ultimately it comes down to funding, and funding in this situation is, as I approach it, means a policy change in the next administration. And so I'm trying to figure out how can I make an impact on the space advisors to the next presidents. And so I'm looking at conducting a set of TED Talks that would be themed on return to the moon. And so I'm working with somebody right now to see if who has experience doing space TED Talks to see if we can pull together a set of probably about four or five speakers at Meteor Crater in northern Arizona as the backdrop for the TED Talk and have some really cool presentations that could present this vision for why a return to the moon makes a lot of sense and why it would be very exciting. And don't really have it's still fairly early and don't have a whole lot to say about it, but just to say that I'm exploring that and talking with people to see if we can pull all the details together, including the funding.
Okay, if you decide to go forward, let us know and
sure.
You can talk about it. Anything you want to summarize or anything else you want to say before we call it a Sunday and head out to the Super Bowl?
Oh, yeah. I've had an opportunity to say a lot, and I really appreciate the participation of yourself and the callers. And as I look this over, I think from a technical standpoint, this is doable. I think it can be developed in a sort of laboratory setting and work out any bugs. But it seems to me as though that this is a relatively low-cost, relatively near-term path towards sustainable space development, not just a permanent base and the historic implications of that, but also I think when you're producing your own materials, your own life support, it's getting awfully close to settlement and even a colony. So I'm optimistic about what is possible, provided that we can just get the funding.
Is there any truth to the fact that you're going to give up medicine and become an aerospace engineer?
There's not even a rumor of that. I'm not planning on it.
I'm starting the rumor right now.
Okay. No, I don't plan on that.
Okay. Listeners, I'll say one other thing. Doug is really good about participating and exchanging notes with people on the blog. So if you want to ask him questions, if you're listening to this show on archives, he does look at the blog, and he's one of the better participants who will respond when he has time. So I'm sure I'm putting words in his mouth, I know, but I'm sure he will be available to answer your questions and to respond to things if you do want to get a hold of him on the blog, and then everybody can benefit from the exchange. So I encourage you to do that.
And my email address is on these materials, so feel free to contact me directly that way as well.
Okay. Doug, we will be in touch, and I want to thank you for doing all of this work. I mean, you really put it together really well. I mean, I'm very
Thanks.
Impressed myself. And I just wish we had some people in policy that cared about doing this kind of stuff. But, you know, maybe that'll change down the road. We'll see. All of you who called in and participated and emailed, thank you also for your calls and your support and your questions and comments. And we're back tomorrow. Look at the newsletters for the week. And we have open lines again. I mean, I've got them pretty close together. But open lines again is next Sunday. Anything and everything goes as long as it's space and STEM related. So we hope to hear from you then as well. Thanks again to Dr. Doug Plata and all of you. Have a good rest of the weekend. And I look forward to the upcoming week with all of you on the Space Show as well. Goodbye from the Space Show.